The Holocaust, Facts versus Fiction. An information brochure on a topic that still impacts many societal and political issues, possibly more than ever. With many references to free e-books and videos. Published and distributed by Academic Research, Media Review, Education Group Limited, London, UK. Version of June 2025. Online at armreg.co.uk, menu option, catalogue. If you wish to access this brochure's numerous book descriptions, please consult the print or ebook versions. War propaganda causes war and genocide. Showing children fictitious horror movies, such as chainsaw massacres, is illegal. Such films traumatize them terribly, causing massive psychological damage. However, showing horror movies allegedly depicting reality, such as films showing what is said to have happened during the Holocaust, is compulsory in many countries of the Western world. The psychological effect on children is catastrophic, especially since they are told that this really happened. Believing they have seen the devil, they are deeply traumatized. Most of us have suffered that kind of treatment, applied to us by well-meaning teachers with stories and movies. Some of these movies are fictitious, such as Schindler's List, but others show real scenes found by British and US troops when reaching German wartime camps in 1945. Particularly memorable are Allied post-war documentaries, such as Death Mills, and Alfred Hitchcock's Memory of the Camps, showing huge numbers of dead concentration camp inmates scattered about and carried to mass graves. See the photo in the print or ebook versions of this brochure. These horror scenes were shown as proof for a deliberate German extermination policy against all kinds of minorities. However, these scenes merely show the result of total war and the subsequent total collapse of Germany at war's end. With the German infrastructure bombed to smithereens, neither food, medicine, water, nor fuel could be supplied either to the camps or to the regular civilian population. Complete disaster reigned everywhere in Germany. Millions of civilians were dying everywhere, particularly in the bombed-out cities. All of Germany was a giant heap of corpses. In that chaos, the camps fared worst. When conquering Germany, the Allies decided to exclusively show photos and footage from the camps, but none taken in German towns and cities, which didn't look much different. That context is usually omitted when showing these images. After all, truth always is the first casualty of war. By 2025, roughly half of all US states have made Holocaust education compulsory, with the other half teaching it voluntarily, in English, history and social studies classes. The technique used, showing distorted, misleading information, is highly questionable, and the targets are defenseless, impressible minors. This is happening in a country that was neither a victim nor a perpetrator in that claimed crime. In Israel and in Jewish communities around the world, children are shown Holocaust movies and told related stories from kindergarten on. They are told, "This happened to your ancestors, and it can happen again. If you don't watch your back, it can even happen to you." With such an education, these children get deeply traumatized. But it doesn't stop there. This kind of conditioning pervades the Jewish cultural sphere from the cradle to the grave. As a result, Jews inevitably develop a persecution paranoia. Under any rock, behind any corner, a non-Jew may hide trying to kill them. If not now, then tomorrow. This pervasive fear of persecution, ethnic cleansing and murder, leads to Jews seeing in non-Jews not just a fellow human, but also a potential threat. It stifles compassion and empathy for non-Jews. It hardens Jews emotionally to the point where they are ready to lash out preemptively, to prevent it from happening again, whatever it was. The result of this multi-generational, lifelong traumatization and re-traumatization can be seen in the Zionists' policy toward Middle Eastern countries in general, and Palestine in particular, West Bank, Gaza. These Zionists expect to always have their way, and show little inclination to find fellowship in non-Jews, who they perceive to be in their way. It has come to the point where any war can be justified, if the enemy can somehow be depicted as a new quote-unquote Hitler about to commit a new Holocaust, Slobodan Milosevic Hitler, Saddam Hussein Hitler, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad Hitler, you name them. On the other extreme end of this indoctrination, German children are told that their ancestors did this to the Jews. It instills in them self-hatred and genocidal wishes. After Auschwitz, they feel, the only good thing Germans can do today is to disappear. Even if everything we are taught about the Holocaust were true, this still does not justify traumatizing children. Such education ought to be limited to young adults, and it must teach all horrors of wars, committed by all sides, as a larger anti-war lesson. It is worth remembering that the biggest butchers usually win the war. These victors then write the history of the vanquished, but rarely in an objective, truthful manner. History in shackles. The Allied chief prosecutor during the post-war Nuremberg military tribunal even admitted this when stating about this trial of quote-unquote victors' justice, quote, "As a military tribunal, this tribunal is a continuation of the war effort of the Allied nations," unquote, International Military Tribunal, Volume 19, page 398. When a trial is used to wage psychological warfare against a defeated nation, then it can hardly serve justice. After the war, Germany was dismembered, a fifth of its population expelled from their homeland in the East, millions of them murdered or starved to death, the German industry was dismantled, patents were plundered, and the whole country deliberately left in a long-term state of starvation, resulting in several million more victims. See James Bach, Crimes and Mercies, Little, Brown and Company, Toronto 1996. This happened mostly as quote-unquote just punishment for the crimes presumably proven at Nuremberg, foremost among them the Holocaust. In addition, a sophisticated re-education program was set in motion which, among other things, was designed to destroy the national pride and wish for independence of the German people once and for all. A member of the US propaganda machine expressed it to a German expert in international law as follows, quote, "No. Atrocity propaganda is how we won the total war. And we are only getting started. We will intensify it until the last spark of sympathy for the Germans has been eradicated, and the German people themselves will be so confused that they will no longer know who they are and what they are doing," unquote, Professor Dr. Friedrich Grimm, Politische Justiz, Die Krankheit unserer Zeit, Schur, born 1953, pages 146-148. But that was right after the war. When the Cold War broke out in 1948, and the Germans were needed as potential cannon fodder against the Soviets, this program of genocide against the German people, originally concocted by U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau, and implemented under President Truman, was finally abandoned. The atrocity propaganda, however, had gotten out of Pandora's box, and it wreaked havoc everywhere in the Western world. To stave off any skepticism about the victor's version of history, starting in the 1980s, more and more Western countries introduced laws threatening with prison terms any such skeptic, no matter how scholarly and well-founded they reason. Taboos are bad. In a society that cordons off certain topics from public scrutiny and open debate, problems remain undiscussed and unresolved. Such taboos tend to metastasize by producing satellite taboos, and all this can eventually poison an entire society, endangering its very existence. The Holocaust is Western society's mother of all taboos. Challenge it, and you are headed for trouble. It drives Western countries into supporting wars and even genocide. It's a very dangerous taboo that needs to be toppled. So let's discuss it. Majdanek. It all started in Majdanek. Majdanek is the name of a German concentration camp on the outskirts of the Polish city of Lublin. It was the first of the large German camps to be occupied by Allied troops in the summer of 1944. It was the first camp that was widely reported in the Allied press. During a press conference on August 25, 1944, the Soviets claimed around 2 million victims for this camp. About a year later, during the Nuremberg military tribunal, the Soviets were still claiming a death toll of up to 1.5 million. Many of these victims are said to have been killed in seven different gas chambers. 3 years after the war, a Polish commission to investigate German crimes in Poland reduced this number to only 360,000. The next drop came after the collapse of the communist Eastern Bloc. At that point, it was said to have been only 235,000 victims. The most recent reduction to 78,000 victims took place in 2005 by the director of the Majdanek Museum. In addition, 5 of the 7 originally claimed gas chambers were no longer mentioned, without explaining their silent scrubbing from history. For more, see the book on the right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. Of the initially claimed 2 million victims, less than 4% are now left. Critical historians have always pointed out that the number of victims was overestimated. They assume around 42,000 documentable victims. Their research also shows that there were no homicidal gas chambers at all in that camp. What was presented as such in the past were simply misunderstood or mislabeled disinfestation systems. Corrections of original claims. Majdanek is not an isolated case. Here is a list of former concentration or extermination camps of the Third Reich. The second column gives the number of victims claimed immediately after the war, the third an approximation of the numbers claimed by the Orthodoxy today, and the last column the post-war exaggeration multiple. Auschwitz, initial death toll, 4 to 8 million, death toll today, 1 million, exaggeration multiple, 4 to 8. Treblinka, initial death toll, 3 million, death toll today, 800,000, exaggeration multiple, 4. Belzec, initial death toll, 3 million, death toll today, 600,000, exaggeration multiple, 5. Sobibor, initial death toll, 2 million, death toll today, 200,000, exaggeration multiple, 10. Majdanek, initial death toll, 2 million, death toll today, 78,000, exaggeration multiple, 26. Chełmno, initial death toll, 1.3 million, death toll today, 150,000, exaggeration multiple, 9. Mauthausen, initial death toll, 1 million, death toll today, 100,000, exaggeration multiple, 10. Sachsenhausen, initial death toll, 840,000, death toll today, 30,000, exaggeration multiple, 28. Dachau, initial death toll, 238,000, death toll today, 41,000, exaggeration multiple, 6. Unintentionally generated, random differences from a set of real numbers, also called errors, are characterized by the fact that overestimates and underestimates are roughly equal in total. In the case of the official casualty figures published first, however, the values were always well above the official figures accepted today. This reveals that the original estimates were deliberately and systematically given far too high. The situation is similar with the murder methods alleged for these camps. The next table contains, in the second column, murder weapons that were claimed during the war or shortly thereafter but are now abandoned as invented. The last column contains the murder weapon claimed today. For details, see the books displayed on the right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. Auschwitz, invented murder weapons, war gases, high voltage, gas showers, gas bombs, pneumatic hammer, conveyor belt, still claimed murder weapon, Zyklon B. Treblinka, invented murder weapons, mobile gas chamber, stunning gas, unslaked lime, hot steam, high voltage, still claimed murder weapon, diesel exhaust gas. Belzec, invented murder weapons, subterranean murder chamber, unslaked lime, high voltage, vacuum, still claimed murder weapon, diesel exhaust gas. Sobibor, invented murder weapons, chlorine gas, a black liquid, collapsible gas chamber floor, still claimed murder weapon, engine exhaust gas. Majdanek, invented murder weapon, Zyklon B, still claimed murder weapon, bottled carbon monoxide, 6 million died. Petty haggling is therefore immoral. Some things may have been exaggerated and invented in the heat of the war, but that would not prove that all claims are false, and above all that does not change the fact that 6 million Jews perished. But is this 6 million figure really a fact or just a mystical number? Since when does the world know that 6 million Jews died? And how do we know? The fact is that this number was already mentioned by some Zionist leaders in June 1945, meaning immediately after the end of the war, although in the chaos prevailing in Europe at the time, it was impossible to carry out population censuses. The Soviets had published this number in their propaganda press by the end of 1944, and a number of American newspapers and magazines had already prophesied during the war that the 6 million Jews living in Hitler's sphere of influence would be systematically exterminated. The earliest such predictions were published right after Germany's victory over France in June 1940. However, the Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann had already mentioned in 1936 that 6 million were in mortal danger. In the 1920s, advertisements and reports in the U.S. press raised huge sums of money to save the 6 million Jews who were supposed to be in mortal danger in Poland and the Soviet Union. The same number of Jews threatened with death can even be found in press reports during the First World War. In fact, reports in U.S. newspapers, especially in the New York Times, have been appearing since the late 19th century claiming that 6 million Jews would be systematically exterminated by the anti-Semitic Tsarist Empire. Even the word Holocaust appeared for the first time in this context. The propaganda carried out since 1880 with the 6 million number should be reason enough to be skeptical of this obviously highly symbolic number. For details, see the book, The First Holocaust, featured on the right in the printed and ebook versions of this brochure. The establishment's only monograph on the subject, whose German title translates to The Scale of the Genocide, determined the number of Jewish victims of the Holocaust, 6 million of course. By subtracting the numbers of Jews who lived in the countries previously ruled or occupied by Hitler a few years after the war from the numbers who lived there according to the last pre-war censuses. What is completely ignored in this method is the fact that in the meantime there had been a massive emigration of Jews to Palestine, meaning Israel, and above all to the USA, but also to many other countries around the globe, and this emigration was definitely encouraged and intensively promoted by the Third Reich. For the emigration policy of the Third Reich, see the book, Jewish Emigration from the Third Reich, presented on the right in the printed and ebook versions of this brochure. Huge droves of emigrants who never faced any mortal danger were thus magically turned into Hitler's victims. A factual comparison of the worldwide Jewish population, not just the European part of it, before and after the Holocaust shows completely different, significantly lower numbers of victims. For details, see the book The Dissolution. On the right in the printed and ebook versions of this brochure. One thing has to be made clear right away. Hopefully we all agree that the first victim of every persecuting state, including the Third Reich, is one too many. Whether there were thousands or millions of victims, injustice remains injustice. But unjustified accusations are wrong as well. Therefore, it must be allowed to express doubts and W-roll equals Amazon VB greater than present slash W opposing arguments. Those who prevent this are putting themselves in the wrong. In addition, every single one of us, whether an expert in this field or not, must always be permitted to examine facts and figures. Those who prevent this are violating our constitutionally protected freedom of conscience. Auschwitz, weighed and found wanting. Auschwitz is the ultimate symbol of evil, said Austrian President Heinz Fischer on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the occupation of the Auschwitz camp by the Red Army. Auschwitz has meanwhile become a menacing portent for everything that is, wants to be or wants to stay German, and by extension anything that is, wants to be or wants to remain European in ethnic and cultural origin. Auschwitz is the German concentration, labor and alleged extermination camp that is the most widely reported, talked about, researched and published of all the Third Reich camps. Auschwitz is considered to be the best researched of all the crime scenes of the Third Reich. And yet it is neglected by mainstream research, because when we look at what the historians of the Auschwitz Museum, the world's leading Orthodox Auschwitz researchers, have written on the issue of the mass extermination of Jews at Auschwitz, we are bitterly disappointed. Only one 300-page book from a 5-volume set, that was published around the turn of the millennium, deals with this topic, and that only very superficially. To counteract this embarrassing situation, the Auschwitz Museum published a small study 10 years later in which 74 documents were reproduced and provided with misleading captions in order to superimpose on these evidentially innocuous or even exculpatory documents some malicious import that they do not have. Critical historians have been able to expose these defamatory falsehoods through detailed archival studies. For details, see the book, Curated Lies, presented over leaf in the printed and ebook versions of this brochure. Although the Auschwitz Museum published an 855-page Auschwitz Chronicle in 1990, claiming to chronicle the events of that camp, this book was based on a series of magazine articles from the late 1950s and early 1960s. These had been published by the Auschwitz Museum in German in communist Poland with the transparent but unfortunately successful aim of manipulating the back-then fledgling Frankfurt Auschwitz trial with atrocity propaganda. An in-depth analysis of this work based on today's knowledge shows that it is full of misrepresentations, lies and deceptions, seen as chronicling Auschwitz on the next page in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. Our two-volume work, The Real Auschwitz Chronicle, on next page in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure, rectifies these deficiencies by showing the world what Czech tried to hide from her readers, real history based on real documents, not witness fairy tales. The scholarly failure of the Auschwitz orthodoxy contrasts with critical historical research, which has presented extensive and detailed individual studies on each chapter of the topic, mass extermination in Auschwitz, which together exceed 5,000 pages. See the books featured on pages 11 to 12 in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. 1. The alleged first gassing of Auschwitz, the claimed starting point of the mass extermination, has been refuted by Metonio as a myth of war propaganda on the basis of many documents stored in the Auschwitz Museum's archives. The Auschwitz Museum, on the other hand, did not get beyond a few meager pages of threadbare, uncritical repetition of unfounded propaganda claims. 2. Phase 2 of the mass murder is said to have taken place in the crematorium of the Auschwitz main camp. Its morgue is said to have temporarily served as an execution gas chamber. The Auschwitz Museum dedicated only a few pages to this topic, based on uncritically cited witness testimony mostly from Stalinist show trials. Metonio, on the other hand, wrote an entire book about it, based on archive documents, critical analysis of witness statements and forensic investigations. It proves that this crime scene, visited by millions to this day, could never have been a homicidal gas chamber for numerous reasons. It also shows that the witnesses saying otherwise contradicted one another and made technically impossible and at times even absurd claims. 3. The same applies to the next steps in the Auschwitz extermination chronology. During the first half of 1942, the gassings are said to have been moved to two small peasant cottages near the Auschwitz-Birkenau sub-camp, then under construction. Again, Orthodox scholars only wrote a few pages on this matter, whereas Metonio presented two studies on this, one on the peasant cottages themselves and the mass extermination process claimed to have occurred in them, and one on the huge outdoor pyres on which the victims of these gassing cottages are said to have been incinerated. There are no documental traces for these cottages. The allegations by witnesses are extremely conflicting, and many claims are technically absurd or impossible. The alleged outdoor mass cremations are ultimately exposed as wartime legends by allied aerial photographs taken in 1944. 4. Finally, there are the four crematoria of the Auschwitz-Birkenau sub-camp, one after the other of which went into operation during the first half of 1943, and all of which are said to have had homicidal gas chambers and ultra-modern cremation furnaces. Once again, the Auschwitz Museum could do no better than to provide a few meager pages about this topic, whereas Metonio contributed two massive tomes on this complex issue, which are supported by literally thousands of sources, totaling over 2,000 pages, including a three-volume technical study on the history, construction and operation as well as the efficiency of the crematoria. These studies clearly show that these facilities did not operate and could not have functioned as mass murder devices, but rather served as instruments to bring the epidemics under control that repeatedly ravaged the camp's inmate population. The Holocaust orthodoxy has absolutely nothing of the kind to offer. The orthodox version of history also proves to be less than convincing when it comes to the forensic examination of the actual murder weapon involved, meaning the poison gas called Zyklon B, hydrogen cyanide absorbed on gypsum pellets, that was allegedly used in the alleged gas chambers at Auschwitz. The Auschwitz Museum merely published a superficial article on this in a Polish journal, while critical historians contributed a 460-page detailed study dealing in depth with this topic, see on the bottom right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. The conclusion of this is that the mass murder scenarios alleged by witnesses were technically impossible. They should also have left chemical traces in the masonry of the alleged gassing rooms, long-term stable compounds of hydrogen cyanide known as iron blue. However, no such traces can be detected. The witnesses. What remains are the witnesses. Here, too, Auschwitz is a prime example, because in addition to the many SS men employed there who testified after the war, there were around 200,000 Auschwitz survivors among the former inmates. Only a tiny fraction of these survivors has testified about mass extermination, but we are still talking about many witnesses. However, if we reduce these statements to those who had first-hand experiences or who testified in sufficient detail to be taken seriously, then we are dealing with not much more than about 30 witnesses out of 200,000 survivors. No serious historian should take any testimony at face value, which was made about events claimed to have occurred during a war, in which both sides used atrocity propaganda to whip up their people and to morally wear down their enemies. Anyone who wants to be taken seriously has to critically examine statements. Is the witness trustworthy? Is his statement credible? Is it coherent or full of internal contradictions? Is it technically possible? Is it supported or refuted by more reliable types of evidence such as documents and material evidence? See Germer Rudolph's contribution on the value of testimony and confessions on the Holocaust in the book Dissecting the Holocaust, presented on the right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. Orthodox historians rarely ask such questions, and they are certainly not examined in detail by them. Critical historians again are different. Each of their books on the topic subjects testimonies to detailed source criticism. A summary of the source criticism of the 30 most important statements about Auschwitz has found that there are insurmountable discrepancies between these statements, and that all of them, to some degree or another, either make claims that are technically impossible, and/or they contradict what is considered reliable historical knowledge based on more reliable evidence. Hence, if lacking better evidence to support these claims, such statements must be discarded as unreliable. See the second book presented on the right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. In the eyes of many people, the most impressive witness statements about Auschwitz are contained in the autobiographical notes of the former commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Huss, which he wrote down while in Polish custody after the war. The Holocaust orthodoxy has so far essentially limited themselves to publishing these records without any criticism. Only a small journal article deals with some chronological peculiarities of Hoss's statements. In contrast to this, critical historians have devoted an entire 466-page book to this key witness, see top right in the printed and e-book versions of this brochure. It documents how Huss was continuously tortured by the British for 3 days after the war, in order to extract a confession from him. It then analyzes the innumerable internal contradictions, the technical impossibilities and absurdities, as well as the anachronisms in Hoss's various statements. In addition, the statements made by Huss about mass extermination are refuted by a large number of documents and other independent studies. The Allies made it clear to Huss that he would only be allowed to live as long as he would make statements considered useful for their purposes of legally and historically indicting the German wartime authorities responsible for the Holocaust, and in extension the entire German nation. And so the lies gushed out of Huss for more than a year in his desperate attempt to postpone his execution as long as possible. He was hanged on April 2, 1947 in the former Auschwitz camp, which he once commanded. One of the most influential witnesses among former Auschwitz inmates was the Jewish physician Dr. Mikos Niesli from Hungary. His statement has also been analyzed in detail by critical historians. See the book presented on the center right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Niesli claimed in his book, first published in 1946, to have worked in one of the crematoria at Auschwitz-Birkenau as an assistant to Dr. Joseph Mengele, and in this position, he claimed to have witnessed the mass murder of Auschwitz in detail. His grotesquely exaggerated statements contradict the statements of other inmates. The most aggravating circumstance damaging his trustworthiness, however, is that he reported in detail about his appearance as a witness during the Nuremberg trial, although he never appeared there as a witness. Nusli's statements are therefore not usable, as it is an incontrovertible fact that he completely invented major parts of his testimony. Many Orthodox historians now consider Nusli to be an unreliable witness. Unfortunately, many later witnesses used Nusli's widely published writings as sources for plagiarism. Another doctor who claims to have been in the same place at the same time as Nusli, the former Auschwitz prisoner Charles S. Bendel, told a different, but equally unbelievable version of events after the war. Both witnesses, however, knew nothing of each other, although they must have worked side by side. Both witnesses therefore made up their stories, at least in part. The SS officer Kurt Gerstein and the former prisoner Rudolf Redder are the only witnesses who have ever testified in detail about the Belzec camp. Here too, only critical historians have submitted a comparative, source-critical study, see bottom right on the previous page, and on page 30 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. It shows very clearly what established historians have so far only noted incidentally: both witnesses contradict themselves, each other, that which was technically possible, and many established historical facts. Hence, they pretty much have no credibility at all. Another very influential witness was Elie Wiesel, whose book, Night, is now required reading in schools in many countries. Interestingly, Wiesel doesn't even have anything to say about gas chambers in his book. In the German translation, however, one must speak of forgery here. Every occurrence of the word crematorium was translated to gas chamber. According to Wiesel's story, the people who were deported with him from Hungary to Auschwitz in May 1944 were burned in huge fire pits right next to the railway ramp, yet Allied air photos of that time prove that no burning pits ever existed there. Wiesel claimed, as did many other witnesses, that huge flames came out of the crematorium chimneys, although this was technically impossible. The smoke flues and chimneys of these facilities were together about 30 meters long, 33 yards, and the coke fires in the cremation furnaces produced practically no flames. Here, too, it was critical historians who presented a critical biography of Elie Wiesel and revealed his numerous misrepresentations. See the book presented at the top right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Three detailed studies of the testimonies of former Auschwitz inmates, who claimed to have removed corpses from the gas chambers and burned them, come to a similarly devastating verdict. These statements are full of exaggerations, absurdities, and technical impossibilities. They are also refuted by a large number of documents. See the three volumes Sonderkommando Auschwitz on the center right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. As already mentioned, wartime aerial photographs in particular clearly show that the gigantic outdoor pyres, on which hundreds of thousands of murdered Jews are said to have been cremated from mid-May to early July 1944, could not have existed. See the book presented to the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. This story of gigantic pit burnings outdoors, also rumored by Elie Wiesel, therefore clearly has to be classified as a made-up story. In conclusion, it can be said that Auschwitz is indeed the best-researched camp of the Third Reich. However, this is not the result of orthodox research, but the result of the tireless efforts of a small group of independent researchers, who are not deterred from their search for the truth, not even by threats and persecution. The orthodox version of history of Auschwitz has been examined in detail by them and has been found wanting: Menna, Menna, Tekel, Hufazin, Old Testament, Daniel 5, 25-31. Why are they spreading untruths? After the communist Eastern Bloc collapsed in 1989-90, the excessively exaggerated claim of a total death toll of 4 million victims for the Auschwitz camp collapsed as well. Very soon, that figure was officially reduced to around 1 million. The Auschwitz Museum had known for many decades that the old figure was massively exaggerated, but it was only possible to change it in 1990. The Auschwitz Museum's research curator at the time, Wacław Dlugoborski, explained in 1998 by what methods the myth of the 4 million Auschwitz victims was sustained in the Eastern Bloc, quote, "Up until 1989 in Eastern Europe, a prohibition against casting doubt upon the figure of 4 million killed was in force. At the memorial site of Auschwitz, employees who doubted the correctness of the estimate were threatened with disciplinary proceedings, unquote, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, September 14, 1998. The freedom to say iconoclastic things on the subject of the Holocaust did not last long in Poland, however, because under Western pressure, Poland introduced a criminal law in 1998 that threatens anyone who denies Nazi crimes with up to 3 years in prison. Thus, the Auschwitz Museum itself helped create those legends that make it a crime for the museum staff to revise them even today, although the overwhelming and self-evident weight of the evidence compel them to do so. Therefore, basically nothing has changed since Joseph Stalin. The situation is similar in many European countries, because there, too, it is outlawed to question or even refute the Orthodox dogma under threat of imprisonment. But even in countries where publicly expressed opposition to the prevailing dogma is not prosecuted, such as in the USA or Great Britain, anyone who touches this third rail loses their job, has their career destroyed, and is expelled from quote-unquote decent society. Anyone who as a historian wants to write honest, critical history without risking their career is therefore well advised to stay away from this topic as much as possible. What remains are mostly dogmatists who are fanatically deluded and who quickly become unobjective and emotional in the face of dissenting opinions, a reaction that is evidently expected, if not demanded, of them by the mainstream media. Independent scholars committed to objective truth, on the other hand, adhere to recognized scientific principles, such as free research in any direction which the evidence, not the media, demands, and coming to conclusions on the basis of generally verifiable facts rather than political expectations. It goes without saying that these independent, critical minds also discuss well-founded, divergent views published by their opponents without prejudice and without personal attacks on those opponents. Critical historians have committed themselves without exception to working as scholars on the basis of generally accepted scientific standards. They see any different kind of approach as unethical, and such an approach would also render their work worthless, into which they invest so much under such extremely difficult circumstances. Those standards include a detailed, sober and factual discussion and evaluation of all relevant publications by authors with different views. Some of their studies are even devoted exclusively to the criticism of publications by conventional schools of thought on the Holocaust. Four such books are listed on the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Five more were presented earlier there, page 7, Inside the Gas Chambers, page 10, Curated Lies, and Mischronicling Auschwitz, page 11, The Real Case for Auschwitz, page 12, Deliveries of Coke. See two more bungled books on page 32 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Studies that do not even mention, let alone discuss, publications containing opposing views, and which tacitly ignore opposing arguments, must be adjudged unscientific. This applies consistently to the entire range of Orthodox publications on the Holocaust. However, it is not these that are described by politics, the judiciary and the media as unscientific or pseudoscientific, but, turning reality upside down, it is the publications of critical historians that are thusly disparaged. This false diametric mislabeling is often used to justify and initiate censorship and bans. Censorship. As a result of this egregious misrepresentation of the studies created by critical historians, these studies are confiscated and burned under police supervision in many European countries, Germany foremost among them. These countries' book wholesalers and retailers are not allowed to offer such books for sale under threat of punishment. These countries' media are not allowed to advertise such books under threat of punishment. But even in countries where no such laws exist, censorship prevails in many regards. YouTube, for instance, deletes all videos and associated accounts that contain critical statements about Orthodox Holocaust claims, no matter how well-founded and justified. Amazon and other international bookstores are deleting all book offers from critical historians from their websites, everywhere in the world. The reason for this is as follows: towards the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, there was a trend reversal on Amazon. For the first time in history, Amazon sold more books by critical historians on the Holocaust than equivalent books published by the Orthodoxy. After years of steady growth, the tipping point was reached where the audience realized that there are two sides to this debate. more and more people were interested in hearing the other side as well. A paradigm shift loomed. But then the emergency brake was pulled in Israel. Two Jewish cemeteries in the U.S. were desecrated, by a storm, as it later turned out. Together with other Jewish organizations, the Jerusalem Holocaust Center Yad Vashem used this as an opportunity to put Amazon under pressure to censor all books by critical historians. At the same time, an Israeli, who was later arrested for this, made hundreds of bomb threats against Jewish community centers in the United States via fake phone calls. The result of this false flag operation was that Amazon stopped selling critical books on the Holocaust. See the book presented on the bottom right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. When critical research into the Holocaust achieved great success in the early 1990s, countermeasures were taken in Germany. Who knows that verbal minutes have never been kept in German criminal trials so that the judges can write whatever suits them in their judgments? In addition, the defense was deprived of the right to introduce exonerating evidence in the 1970s. Since then, the defense has had to ask the judges to do that. In view of the success of critical historians, it was enforced in the 1990s that the judges in trials against history dissidents can, in principle, must, reject all requests for evidence from the defense. If they do not, they will face criminal prosecution themselves. The next step was to ensure that defense lawyers and defendants who still submit evidence to support dissident views can be punished for this. Then a law was passed that allows judges to gag the defense attorney altogether. All of this shows that the U.S.'s founding fathers were ingenious when adding the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but that the peoples in many other countries were less fortunate. It also shows that having a constitutionally guaranteed right isn't enough. Corporate censorship by companies that have quasi-monopoly status can be quite as effective as laws enforced at the point of a gun. A democracy depends on citizens being able to access information unimpededly. Hence, where there is censorship, democracy is a mere joke. And a state that dictates at the point of a gun what we can and cannot say is a dictatorship. Lies have to rely on bayonets to survive. The truth stands by itself. Mass shootings by task forces. The Holocaust allegedly did not start with the extermination camps Auschwitz, Treblinka, etc., which later became notorious, but rather in a rather rampant way by means of uncontrolled mass shootings of Jews by German task forces, Einsatzgruppen, on the territory of the Soviet Union after the outbreak of the German-Soviet War. The Orthodoxy has presented quite a large number of studies on this subject, all of which are characterized by the fact that testimonies are accepted uncritically, Soviet war propaganda is believed unseen, and the contents of documents are adopted without being examined. In view of the escalation that Stalin began right at the beginning of this war, there is no question that massacres also occurred on the German side, and since Jews were regarded as the ultimate enemy by the Third Reich, it can be assumed that Jews, who were vastly overrepresented in partisan activities against German units, were the primary victims in such incidents. The question is, however, to what extent this happened and whether there was an intention and a system of genocide behind it. Again, a detailed study by a critical historian was required to clarify that here as well, Orthodox scholars produced misleading, incorrect and incomplete presentations. See the book on the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. First of all, not only is there a lack of documentary evidence of a genocide plan, but on the contrary, the documents indicate that such a policy did not exist. Orthodox researchers have already established that the so-called task force reports, which show the number of civilians murdered by these units, are often contradictory of themselves. In his study, Matonio meticulously reveals all the numerical inconsistencies and contradictions of the various task force reports. In order to clarify whether, and if so, to what extent the numbers of victims listed therein, sometimes implausible from the start, correspond to reality, one would have to locate at least a representative number of mass graves, exhume them and carefully examine their contents forensically. Unfortunately, however, this is prevented mainly by Jewish organizations who assert that their religion forbids disturbing the graves. Hence, scholars instead continue to rely on obviously unreliable documents as well as on testimonies mainly collected by Stalinist post-war commissions, which are often peppered with absurdities, especially when it comes to claims about exhumations with subsequent cremation of the murder victims on huge pyres, as allegedly carried out by German forces since early 1943. Gas fans. The alleged plan to annihilate the European Jews, although undocumented, is said to have been given a material structure for the first time in the form of the claimed extermination camp near the town Kulmhof or Chełmno in German-occupied Poland. Three so-called gas vans are said to have been used in this camp, meaning trucks with a cargo box into which the exhaust gases from the truck's engine were discharged in order to kill victims locked up inside. It was again critical historians who for the first time ever presented detailed studies on both the subject of Chełmno and the gas vans. See the two books featured on the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. A whole series of 30 diesel trucks of the Sauer make is said to have been converted into gas vans and then used in the Soviet Union by the task forces for gas murders. The problem with this is that diesel exhaust contains too little toxic carbon monoxide to be effective in killing anyone. Experiments with small mammals, which are much more sensitive than humans, have shown that it takes up to 5 hours to kill them with diesel exhaust under the most lethal circumstances. The origin of the myth of diesel gas vans can be found in Soviet propaganda starting in 1943, when show trials were conducted against Ukrainian collaborators and German prisoners of war in Kharkov and Krasnodar. Use of a diesel engine was touted as a diabolical German invention. A very thorough overview of the testimony presented in support of the gas van hypothesis clearly shows that the witnesses testified everything imaginable and even the unthinkable on this subject. No fantasy was bizarre enough not to be testified to and accepted in this regard. This is the inevitable result if Holocaust survivors are glorified as living saints beyond critique, and anything they say is blindly accepted as unquestionable truth. Such arbitrary testimonies are of no use. As expected, there are no documentary or material traces of these gas vans. None of these gas vans has ever been found, no photo has ever been presented, and no document indicates that such vehicles have ever been built or converted for murder purposes. It's all smoke and mirrors. Mass graves, mass incineration, exhumations. Of the five camps called extermination camps by the Orthodoxy, only Auschwitz had regular crematoria. Chełmno is said to have had a primitive field furnace set into the ground, while at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka, the corpses are said to have been burned on rail grates within a short period of time. The few works that Orthodox researchers have published on these camps so far are characterized by a complete lack of consideration for the logistical challenges that the construction and maintenance of the number and size of pyres would have posed, which would have been required for the quantity of corpses claimed to have been burned on them. Compare Dalton's book on debating the Holocaust, presented below in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure, in which the arguments of both sides are compared. Thousands of corpses are said to have been dug up from mass graves in these camps every day and then burned on pyres. However, if you look at the testimonies of so-called camp survivors, you get the impression that these pyres built themselves, that no fuel was needed to keep them aflame, and that the unburned remains of more than a million incompletely combusted human corpses dissolved into thin air all by themselves. More or less detailed forensic investigations on the grounds of these former camps, which have been carried out by Orthodox researchers especially in the last two decades, have led to great disappointments, especially with regard to Belzec and Treblinka. Due to the high number of victims claimed for these camps, massive traces of huge mass graves and cremation pits were to be expected, but this could not be confirmed. See the monographs on these camps as presented on pages 7 and 21 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Therefore, Dr. Thomas Dalton wrote the following on the Treblinka camp in his previously mentioned book, quote, "I think it's safe to say that, after 75 long years, the Orthodox story of the Treblinka death camp is all but dead," unquote. Not the least reason for this is the fact that for 70 years it was claimed that at the Belzec and Treblinka camps the Jews were murdered with diesel exhaust gases. In the meantime, however, Orthodoxy has had to admit that this would not have been possible because diesel exhaust gases are simply not toxic enough. After all other alleged murder methods for the Treblinka and Belzec camps had previously been dropped, see the table earlier in this book, there are no supporting facts for the thesis that they were extermination camps. See Friedrich Berg's contribution on diesel exhaust mass murder claims in the book Dissecting the Holocaust, presented on page 14 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. How today's narrative was created. Mainstream historians insist that the accusation of having systematically murdered 6 million Jews was convincingly demonstrated during the Nuremberg International Military Tribunal, IMT. However, that trial also blamed the Soviet cut-in murders on Germans, systematically exaggerated the death toll of all camps, and claimed completely invented murder methods, see the tables on page 6 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure, and even falsely accused the Germans of having used an atom bomb to instantly annihilate 20,000 Jews, IMT, volume 16, pages 529 and following. When considering that the IMT's rules were rigged in such a way that the defendants were practically defenseless, that much of the evidence presented during the IMT was created by way of torture, blackmail, forgery and phony quote-unquote expert reports, and that many claims are rejected as false even by mainstream historians today, such as camp inmates turned into soap, lubricants, shrunken heads etc., it becomes clear that this trial had little if anything to do with getting to the truth of the matter. For a detailed analysis on this, see the book on the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Yet still, the power of Allied propaganda made the world believe that this Nuremberg show trial proved the prosecution's case. Never mind the fact that the story told during that trial has often little in common with what Orthodox historians tell us today, death tolls were reduced drastically, and most claimed murder methods were relegated to the memory hole. So how did we get from the IMT's evidently false propaganda claims to the story told today? Homicidal gas chambers are the iconic core of the Holocaust narrative. Revealing the roots and evolution of their history allows us to answer that question. As mentioned before, if we investigate the history of this story, we find early accounts from the wartime and immediate post-war period that tell quite a different story from what we are told today. They speak of steam chambers, vacuum chambers, electrocution chambers, murder with chlorinated lime in trains, or with toxic fluids. We read of gas bombs, of gas streaming through showerheads, and of collapsible gas chamber floors, discharging bodies in carts underneath, to name only a few examples. Mainstream historians admit that none of it was true, and they usually sweep these embarrassing stories under the proverbial rug. Evidently, someone clouded the historical record with a lot of nonsense during and right after the war, and then someone else cleaned it up. But who did what? There's no shortage of culprits for inventing atrocity stories, because all countries involved in World War II spread atrocity tales about their enemies. The interesting question is, who used which criteria to conclude which of the many stories is true? For 60 years, the Orthodoxy insisted that the bulk of the gas chamber mass murder happened in six camps: Auschwitz, Belzec, Chełmno, Majdanek, Sobibor, and Treblinka. While Majdanek was almost completely removed from this list in 2005, the rest is still standing. Following the historiographic trail backward, we can uncover with certainty who created the narrative we are told today about these six camps. Just four Polish individuals, one historian and three investigative judges, are at the core of this transformation, from utter anecdotal anarchy to a streamlined, apparently consistent and coherent narrative: Eugeniusz Schreit, for Belzec; Władysław Bednarz, for Chełmno; Zdzisław Łukaszkiewicz, for Majdanek, Sobibor and Treblinka; and Jan Sen, for Auschwitz, with major, later assistance by Polish historian Danuta Czech. These four Poles settled on the most likely storyline, cherry-picked evidence that seemed to confirm it, and discarded mountains of evidence contradicting it. They wrote articles in the years 1946 to 1948 that defined paradigms about these camps, which all historians and courts of law have been parroting ever since. For more details, see the book, Nazi Gas Chambers, advertised in the print and e-book version of this brochure. Why Poland? All victorious powers of World War II had a vested interest in weakening Germany as much as possible during and right after the war. That included breaking German self-confidence by encumbering that nation with a guilt complex for having committed terrible atrocities. However, with the Cold War rising since the Berlin blockade in 1948, the victorious powers lost an interest in weakening the part of Germany that had come under their control. There was one exception to that rule, though. After two world wars, Poland had annexed, with the assistance of the victorious powers, large swaths of German territories, and had expelled millions of its original native German population. In fact, roughly 50% of all territories today considered Poland used to be German before the end of World War I. The vast majority of these territories had been populated by ethnic Germans for centuries. How could Germany be made to accept such huge territorial losses and to condone the genocidal ethnic cleansing of its population from these areas? Guilt for the Holocaust. And that is why Poland, to this day, loves to rub gas chamber salt in open German wounds. Israel joined the fray of this lucrative business only rather late, in 1961 with the infamous Eichmann Show trial. At that time, the narrative had already been cast into historical stone, mainly by Polish historians and the Polish judiciary. Don't lose your firm footing. After absorbing information such as that presented in this brochure, the following reactions can be expected from many people who have previously only known the officially approved version of this irksome and charged complex of topics. 1. Spontaneous and outraged rejection, maybe even calls to the police. People with such intense, emotional reactions often quit reading after just a few lines, or they cannot comprehend the facts presented due to their prejudices. 2. Moral confusion, disbelief, horror, maybe even anger. If all this is true, then we all have been lied to and have been betrayed in the most serious way. How can you still believe anything at all? Believe French historian Paul Rassinia. Because he obtained false passports for Jews during World War II so they could flee from France, the Germans arrested and deported him to the Buchenwald camp and later to the Dora-Mittelbau forced labor camp. After the war, Rassinia wrote a book about his experiences. In it, you can read how the prisoners in the German camp suffered from privation and abuse, but also how his fellow inmates often enough spread bizarre exaggerations about the concentration camps after the war, for various reasons. See the book presented on the previous page in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. While conditions in German wartime labor camps were at times bad, they were not so by design. Mainstream claims of quote-unquote extermination through labor are refuted by detailed analyses of wartime records and a multitude of post-war affidavits, even of former inmates. The Auschwitz-Monowitz labor camp, for example, was considered one of Germany's best camps, so the inmates stated. See the study at the top right in the print and ebook version of this brochure. Rassinia reminds us that the Third Reich was a dictatorship that trampled civil rights underfoot. Nobody should wish for something like that to happen again. You don't need gas chambers or a plan of mass murder to commit such crass violations of civil rights. A relativistic attitude towards civil rights is enough to turn a community into hell for certain minorities. This is no different in Germany and many other European countries today, where many people seriously believe that it is necessary to burn books and persecute dissidents in order to prevent another system to rise that burns books and persecutes dissidents. They don't realize that they are the new tyrants. By showing that today's historiography of the Third Reich is inaccurate in many areas, see the book on other subject areas of the Third Reich on the right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure, we are not justifying the crimes actually committed at the time, which are plenty, but rather we are exposing the hypocrisy of many of today's Western societies that pay lip service to civil rights, particularly when violated by China, Russia or North Korea, but that react no differently from the Third Reich to dissident voices they violently reject, with censorship, bans, persecution and prosecution. Today we do not need less respect for fundamental civil rights and the rule of law, on the contrary, we need much more rule of it. Here you can find out more. We encourage you to critically question what has been set out here. The subject is far too important and the consequences of deviating from the official version too serious to be taken lightly. In addition, we are not infallible. We make mistakes, and we have to revise our opinion on occasion, just as you hopefully will revise yours as needed. Therefore, inform yourself in detail before you form an opinion, which must also be continuously updated to reflect new information. Encyclopedia. The best way to get concise up-to-date information on critical research on the Holocaust is by visiting the Revisionist Holocaust Encyclopedia at www.nukebook.org. It is continually updated and expanded. This encyclopedia can also be obtained as a reference book, ebook, audiobook, hardcover. See the ad on page 34 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Books. If you are looking for introductory books on the subject, we suggest the following titles. The best brief introduction into the topic of the Holocaust is Thomas Dalton's very affordably priced, 115-page booklet, The Holocaust, An Introduction. See the book presented at the top right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. For some more detailed information, we recommend Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. See bottom right in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. In this work, English science historian Dr. Nicholas Colostrum explains the Holocaust issue in readily accessible terms from both a scientific and a societal point of view. With around 260 pages of text, this book has become our bestseller in the Holocaust category. The 310-page book, Debating the Holocaust, see page 22 in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure, goes a little deeper into the subject. Professor of Philosophy Dr. Dalton probes the subject by contrasting and comparing the main arguments of both sides in this dispute, which officially does not even exist. For an even more comprehensive book of almost encyclopedic scope, we recommend the 530-page book, Lectures on the Holocaust, which has been called a reference work due to its extensive coverage of the topic. See next page in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Due to its unusual style of dialogue, the book is at the same time a gripping read, because these dialogues draw the reader straight into the debate. Despite its size, the book is very reasonably priced, and can be downloaded as a free ebook at www.holocausthandbooks.com. For those who really want to learn all the details, we recommend the individual volumes of our Holocaust Handbook series, many of which are mentioned and introduced throughout this brochure. They all can be downloaded free of charge from www.holocausthandbooks.com as ebooks, PDF, EPUB. See ad on the next page in the printed and PDF versions of this brochure. Hence, it doesn't cost you anything to get the information these books contain, and you can even redistribute these files free of charge. Documentaries. Next, find free video documentaries at www.holocausthandbooks.com, which address many of the topics discussed here, such as The First Holocaust, The Surprising Origin of the 6 Million Figure, traces the origin of the myth of 6 million Jewish victims back into the 19th century. One Third of the Holocaust, documents and scrutinizes mass murder claims made about the camps at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. Auschwitz, The Surprising Hidden Truth, analyzes central topics about mass extermination claims for this camp. Curated Lies, The Auschwitz Museum's Misrepresentations, Distortions, and Deceptions, documents the world's largest Holocaust museum's mendacious ways of duping its visitors. The Lies and Deceptions of Deborah Lipstadt, two parts, reveals the dishonesty and underhandedness of one of the most prominent proponents of the Orthodox Holocaust narrative. The Day Amazon Murdered Free Speech shows how Amazon systematically censors books unwelcome by influential pressure groups. The Chemistry of Auschwitz delves into the nitty-gritty of the toxicology and forensics of Zyklon B and the chemical traces it leaves behind. Probing the Holocaust, The Horror Explained, discusses the horrific imagery of mountains of corpses in German camps, as taken by Western allies in early 1945. Periodical. Since the year 2009, our quarterly periodical Inconvenient History has maintained the true spirit of the historical revisionist movement. This movement was established already after the First World War, to foster peace through an objective understanding of the causes of modern warfare. Our journal contains opinion pieces, reviews, introductory and overview articles, as well as deep diving research papers. They are posted online, freely accessible for everyone, at inconvenienthistory.org. Every year's issues are collected in one volume and published as a paperback edition. These can be purchased either as print editions at armreg.co.uk or downloaded free of charge as PDF files, reduced image resolution, at inconvenienthistory.org. To see a list of contributions featured in each volume, please visit the journal's website. Thank you for listening. You can obtain a free PDF version of this brochure at armreg.co.uk, menu option catalog.